Chapter 8. White Mischief. Dr. Fauci's African Atrocities. They increased the number of diseases from 2 to nearly 30 that could be classified as AIDS, and after that they started a global testing program of vulnerable populations, which just coincidentally happened to be people not in a position to defend themselves easily. They started to find AIDS everywhere, including in Africa, but including in the United States, and wouldn't you know, one of the communities they found was the African-American community, and they tested a lot of women, and they found a lot of HIV-positive women, and they decided, well, let's go forward. Carrie Mullis, winner of the 1993 Nobel Prize for Chemistry. As Vera Sharaw points out, racism is an abiding feature of medical authoritarianism and human experimentation. Molecular biologist Harvey Bialy, the editor of the Nature Biotechnology Journal, observed that the subtle backdrop of racial and sexual bigotry and bullying are the distinguishing attributes of AIDS research. The fearful fascination with the contagion was amplified by the official narrative that the disease originated in Africans doing weird things with monkeys and spread to the voodoo kingdom of Haiti, and that the sexual depravity of homosexuals drove the disease into the United States. Dr. Fauci's critic, Charles Ortleb, the editor of New York Native and author of a biography of the NIAID director, recalls that the theme of unwanted minorities spreading contagion was a standardized soliloquy of totalitarianism, most notoriously Hitler's stoking of public fears of tuberculosis to incite bigotry toward Jews. There was always this undertone of bigotry with AIDS. I don't think we can dismiss as coincidence that the population that they targeted for their toxic concoctions were gays, blacks, Hispanics, and Africans. And Dr. Fauci did not restrict his unethical experiments with AIDS drugs to American children. By June 2003, NIH and NIAID were running 10,906 clinical trials in 90 countries, and Dr. Fauci's pioneering AIDS branch, newly christened DAIDS, Division of Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome, was testing new toxic antiviral concoctions in some 400 clinical trials in the United States and globally. Dr. Fauci's PIs targeted developing nations that lacked strong institutional structures for protecting impoverished citizens from the abusive practices of powerful pharmaceutical multinationals. According to Vera Sharaw, Dr. Fauci had NIAID and its pharmaceutical company partners move his most controversial and risky studies offshore because they can do stuff that they could never get away with in the United States. Journalist Celia Farber concurs with Sharaw's assessment. The racism is cloaked inside carefully crafted philanthropic manipulations such as access to drugs. It's never access to clean drinking water, education, sanitation, nutrition. It's a very blighting message for the U.S. to constantly be browbeating Africans with our self-serving messaging that they are so sick and we have just the drugs to save their lives. When the opposite happens, it's swept away and hidden behind the false front of charity. I call it pharma colonialism. Africa has been a pharma colony for over a century. It is the venue of choice for companies seeking cooperative government officials, compliant populations, the lowest per patient enrollment costs, and lax oversight by media and regulatory officials. Powerless, often illiterate, and if necessary, disposable quasi-volunteers allow pharma's PIs to paper over even catastrophic side effects and mistakes. In 2005, FDA officials learned that Dr. Fauci's DAIDS team had concealed scores of deaths and hundreds of injuries during HIV drug trials in Africa with another of his toxic chemotherapy vanity products, Nevirapine. Dr. Fauci's fingerprints were all over DAIDS's sketchy African experiments. In October 1988, his success at getting approval for AZT won him the equivalent of a $1 billion lottery for a career technocrat, a mention during then-Vice President George H.W. Bush's presidential debate. You've probably never heard of him. He's a very fine researcher, top doctor at National Institute of Health, working hard, doing something, research on this disease of AIDS. The accolade gained him an even larger prize, access to and the trust of the new president. Two administrations later, Dr. Fauci warned President George W. Bush that HIV had gotten a toehold in Africa and was spreading like wildfire. He persuaded the president to demonstrate his bona fides as a compassionate conservative by redirecting the United States foreign aid spending into the heroic enterprise of eliminating African AIDS. Accordingly, on January 19, 2002, President Bush announced a $15 billion package to combat AIDS, including a $500 million program to purchase millions of doses of nevirapine for distribution to African mothers and children. Dr. Fauci told the president that nevirapine would save millions of lives by preventing maternal transmission of HIV to unborn children. President Bush would later repeat this promise in his 2003 State of the Union address. Dr. Fauci's artful 1988 achievement of winning FDA approvals for AZT had launched the AIDS drug gold rush. Nevirapine was German pharmaceutical giant Boehringer Ingelheim's beachhead in the race. Boehringer had apparently lifted nevirapine from the same toxic junk pile from which Burroughs Wellcome had retrieved AZT. Canadian regulators rejected nevirapine in 1996 and 1998 due to its potent toxicity and dubious efficacy. In December 2000, the Journal of the American Medical Association advised healthcare workers exposed to HIV to avoid prescribing nevirapine after the drug caused life-threatening liver toxicity in patients. A 2001 FDA review reported 20 serious adverse events, meaning death, hospitalization, life-threatening or permanently disabling, resulting from brief prophylactic nevirapine exposure. Nevertheless, the German chemical company found a soft landing for its product at NIAID. Another drug too big to fail. Dr. Fauci apparently neglected to tell President Bush that nevirapine had never won FDA approval as a safe and effective drug. Dr. Fauci had to know all about the safety problems, but he must have either omitted or whitewashed them when he sold the program to Bush, says Celia Farber, who researched the episode extensively for her 2006 article in Harper's Magazine. NIAID's powerful apparatchik didn't fret that FDA had already refused nevirapine its official safety imprimatur. Dr. Fauci seemed confident that he eventually could get FDA to give him anything he wanted, Farber told me. In the early 1990s, Ugandan dictator Yoweri Museveni rolled out the red carpet for pharma. Uganda became one of many African nations seeking to cash in on the lucrative business of farming out their citizens for the booming clinical trial business. In 1997, Uganda granted Dr. Fauci's Johns Hopkins-based PI, Brooks Jackson, permission to run clinical trials on nevirapine in Kampala. NIAID's AIDS division, DAIDS, was sole sponsor of a study to test the efficacy and safety of nevirapine and AZT on preventing maternal transmission of HIV to newborns. DAIDS codenamed its Ugandan clinical trial HIV-NET-012. In 1999, Jackson and his team reported in the medical journal Lancet, nevirapine lowered the risk of HIV-1 transmission during the first 14 to 16 weeks of life by nearly 50% in a breastfeeding population. This simple and inexpensive regimen could decrease mother-to-child HIV-1 transmission in less developed countries. Fauci acolytes hailed this success as NIAID's largest triumph against HIV to date. Congress voted a hefty hike to the NIH budget. But the study's sunny conclusions concealed glaring methodological deficiencies. When they can get away with it, pharma researchers commonly employ the highly unethical gimmick of eliminating the placebo control group in order to mask injuries in the study group. The absence of an inert placebo comparator group allows PhD grifters to dismiss all injuries and deaths in the study group as sad coincidences not associated with the drug they are testing. DAIDS's official nevirapine clinical trial protocols required an inert placebo group, but once in Uganda, DAIDS's cowboy research team simply made the placebo group vanish. Instead of using a placebo, Jackson and his team ended up comparing the health outcomes in 626 pregnant women, half of whom took Dr. Fauci's horrendously dangerous chemotherapy concoction AZT, while the other half took nevirapine. Based on this study, Dr. Fauci was able to persuade the WHO in 2000 to grant emergency use authorization approval, EUA, to single-dose nevirapine for preventing mother-to-child transmission of HIV as its official recommendation. WHO was already a sock puppet for Big Pharma. Dr. Fauci used the stopgap WHO approval to persuade President Bush to purchase millions of dollars of nevirapine. Boehringer began shipping cartons of its deadly and ineffective drug to clinics and maternity wards in 53 developing nations. The Boehringer study enrolled 626 supposedly HIV-infected pregnant Ugandan women. Even at its best, HIV diagnosis in Africa is a casual affair, seldom verified by blood tests, and NIAID's trial team had a particularly cavalier approach to determining HIV infection. It is therefore unclear how many of the agency's recruits were actually HIV positive. From day one, the researchers trampled virtually all the study's safety efficacy protocols, including the most critical requirement in dosing safety studies, a genuine placebo control group. The gimmick of equalizing the carnage in both AZT and nevirapine study groups allowed the NIAID researchers to cobble together the sunny assessment of both drugs, which they published in The Lancet in summer of 1999. Using the deceptive code words that are de rigueur in NIAID's official reports of its clinical trials, the researchers reported that the two regimens were well tolerated. Their proof of this fraudulent assertion was that adverse events were similar in the two groups. Only the fine print of the Lancet study revealed that 38 babies had died, 16 in the nevirapine group, and 22 in the AZT group. But as we shall see, that deceptive swindle was just the start of the mayhem. A NIAID project officer later complained to Farber that the Ugandan trials were out of control and researchers were trampling safety and regulatory standards. In July 2001, Boehringer Ingelheim filed a supplemental application to the FDA to market nevirapine for preventing mother-to-child transmission, PMTCT, of HIV, solely based upon NIAID's Uganda trials. However, stories were already trickling back to Washington that Dr. Fauci's Kampala trials that underpinned the Lancet paper were a three-ring circus of flim-flam fraught with serious accuracy and ethical issues. It was at this time that the FDA, in keeping with standard procedure regarding planned inspections of a foreign site, announced that it was sending investigators to Uganda. That declaration apparently irked Dr. Fauci and his NIAID team and terrified his Beringer partners. In January 2002, Beringer dispatched an audit team to Kampala. In exchange for FDA agreeing to delay its visit, Beringer promised to share its inspection report with the U.S. licensing agency. That report did little to assuage FDA's alarm. Beringer's own investigators described grisly mayhem in Kampala. The NIAID study was in shambles, including serious noncompliance with FDA regulations. In its efforts to win FDA approvals for the dangerous and ineffective concoction, DAID's team had violated virtually every good clinical practice, including the unlawful failure to employ the standardized informed consent procedure of disclosing serious risks to study participants. Beringer's damning inspection report only heightened concern at FDA. In hopes of forestalling the FDA inspection, NIAID in February 2002 hired a private consultant group, Westat, to conduct an investigation and audit of the Kampala site. It's fair to assume that Dr. Fauci's crew was hoping for a whitewash from Westat, but Westat used seasoned auditors whose backgrounds included inspections on behalf of the FDA, and the Westat audit confirmed the long inventory of severe violations of good clinical practice, including, most disturbingly, the convenient loss of critical records. The missing records included a vital logbook that appeared to have documented the study's worst atrocities before its mysterious disappearance. NIAID's Uganda team told the Westat researchers that they had lost the critical log that, among other things, recorded all the adverse events and deaths. The remaining records didn't report which mothers received which drugs, or even whether they survived the study. The auditors reported a scene of pure chaos. Drugs were given to the wrong babies, documents were altered, and there was infrequent follow-up, even though one-third of the mothers were marked abnormal in their charts at discharge. The infants who did receive follow-up care were in many cases small and alarmingly underweight. It was thought to be likely that some, perhaps many, of these infants had serious health problems. When Westat chose a random sample of 43 of those infants to examine, all of them had adverse events 12 months after the study terminated. Only 11 of them were HIV positive. When Westat confronted Dr. Jackson's researchers with study discrepancies, they admitted that they routinely applied more lenient standards for their black Ugandan subjects than FDA rules required for U.S. safety studies. The PIs admitted to systematically downgrading standardized definitions of serious adverse events to adapt to local standards. Injuries that researchers would score as serious or deadly if they happened to white Americans became minor injuries when black Africans were the victims. Under their relaxed rubric, clinical trials staff scored life-threatening injuries as not serious. When they reported them at all, NIAID classified mortalities among its African volunteers as serious adverse events rather than death. NIAID's Ugandan team had entirely neglected to report thousands of adverse events and at least 14 deaths. Dr. Fauci's PI, Dr. Brooks Jackson, acknowledged that he had avoided reporting thousands of AEs and SAEs, adverse and severe adverse events, by applying those diluted definitions of serious and of severity. Researchers specifically excluded from the reports all deaths that occurred more than a few months after the study ended. When Westat pushed for answers, the NIAID Hopkins local team pleaded that no one had trained them in good clinical practice and that they had never attempted a Phase 3 trial. Finally, the Westat auditors refused to sign off on Avirapin because they could find no valid data suggesting that this highly toxic drug prevented HIV transmission. After receiving Westat's audit report, panic-stricken NIAID and Boehringer officials again feared FDA making its own planned site visit. But Dr. Fauci had already pushed his beleaguered sister agency past its high tolerance for bureaucratic humiliation. FDA demanded to see the Westat report. Dr. Jonathan Fishbein told me that when FDA regulators finally reviewed the Westat report, they read the riot act to NIAID and Boehringer's officers. FDA instructed Boehringer to withdraw its application for Avirapin's approval or face the mortification of a public FDA rejection. In March 2002, Boehringer Ingelheim consequently pulled its supplemental FDA application for Avirapin's approval, and the Johns Hopkins NIAID team closed the scandal-ridden Ugandan study site. The decision to shorten the study occurred at a tense meeting between the FDA and the NIAID. Everyone knew the enormous implications of the audit findings. FDA's refusal to rubber-stamp Avirapin's approval meant the collapse of the Bush administration's most visible foreign policy program. Dr. Fauci had persuaded the president to make the abolishment of African AIDS his moonshot project, his career legacy, and Avirapin was the foundation stone of that project. The severe embarrassment to the president and to the NIH would also engulf Uganda's Makerere University, Boehringer, the investigators, and their employers, Johns Hopkins University and Family Health International, FHI, the organization responsible for monitoring the trial. It would antagonize the South African government, whose drug regulatory agency, the Medicines Control Council, MCC, permitted the distribution of Avirapin under duress based solely on the fraudulent results of the Uganda study published in Lancet in 1999. Curiously, Dr. Fauci did not attend the meeting to take responsibility for his institute's leading role in the catastrophe. He dispatched his underlings to absorb the spanking. It was a great embarrassment to the Bush administration, because that was their big initiative, recalls Farber. In any other circumstances, Avirapin would have been DOA in FDA's licensing process. But Avirapin was Tony Fauci's baby. He had staked his credibility with the president on the success of this trial. Like AZT, Avirapin was therefore too big to fail. Such desperate circumstances summoned Teflon Tony to perform his greatest magic act, resurrect the dead. Tony Fauci knew that Avirapin had fundamental safety and efficacy deficits that went way beyond record-keeping, says Farber. Those problems were existential. The drug didn't work, and it killed both mothers and children. According to Farber, two inspections had now declared HIV-NET-012 to be a complete mess, Boehringer's own and Westat's, which had been performed in conjunction with NIAID. But the ways in which the various players were tethered together made it impossible for NIAID to allow the study to die without embarrassing Dr. Fauci in his relationship with President Bush, and without implicating NIAID in the Uganda scandal. NIAID sprang into cover-up mode. Dr. Fauci, by now adept at manipulating both elected officials and a credulous press, had his PR team begin the resurrection project by refashioning the Uganda charnel house scandal as a simple misunderstanding based on minor clerical errors. Blithely ignoring FDA's dire safety and efficacy signals and Boehringer's demeaning withdrawal, NIAID issued a press release characterizing its Ugandan atrocities as mere record-keeping glitches. NIAID's statement claimed that while certain aspects of the collection of the primary data may not conform to FDA regulatory requirements, no evidence has been found that the conclusions of HIV NET012 are invalid or that any trial participants were placed at an increased risk of harm. To the contrary, the communique assured the public NIAID's trial had proven nevirapine both safe and effective. Summoning his extensive web of loyal dependencies, Dr. Fauci lined up a host of organizations, including the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, Johns Hopkins, Boehringer Ingelheim, and others, to issue statements and press releases supporting NIAID's official narrative. NIAID portrayed the devastating Boehringer withdrawal as merely a temporary setback, which Dr. Fauci, in a perverse but inspired twist of Orwellian newspeak, recast as an admirable demonstration of corporate responsibility. In July 2002, DAIDS announced that it would reassess the Uganda nevirapine study with its own in-house remonitoring protocol, a fancy construction for whitewash, managed by Fauci's top AIDS henchman, DAIDS Director Edmund Tremont. However, in an uncharacteristic faux pas, Tremont included his hand-picked DAIDS in-house review team, which included the agency's medical officer, Dr. Betsy Smith, who was not down for the cover-up. During her document inspection, Dr. Smith took notice of the poor quality and the incompleteness of the safety data. Shoddy record-keeping at the site revealed that the study did not comply with good clinical practice, GCP, guidelines. GCP is a requirement for all NIH-funded clinical research, and any studies conducted for the purpose of supporting the safety and effectiveness of investigational drugs. Dr. Smith's draft safety report raised all kinds of noisome alarms. She noted that medical records such as clinical notes, which are source documents needed to validate study data, were missing, incomplete, and often unsigned or undated. This made it difficult to validate the occurrence of adverse events. Poor quality clinical records were below expected standards of clinical research, especially for a study of such great importance. Smith and regulatory branch chief Mary Ann Luzar also uncovered serious health injuries in the chaotic Uganda safety records. Babies in the AZT arm were showing consistently elevated liver enzymes, injuries consistent with nevirapine's long history of provoking lethal liver failure. She found that the Uganda team had neglected to report numerous infant deaths and routinely failed to track patients who had abnormal lab values, clinical signs, and symptoms to determine how these problems resolved. Further complicating that problem, the study team did not interpret laboratory results using the standard toxicity grading scales that the protocol required, but had spitballed their assessment using less stringent grading scales and creating a team-defined reporting algorithm for study with the goal to report fewer AEs and SAEs, adverse and serious adverse events. This was the delicate lingua franca that bureaucrats employ to accuse one another of fraud. Dr. Jackson had not trained his study staff on how to report SAEs, and his team neither tracked nor reported AEs, including serious ones. Instead of treating these grave deficiencies with appropriate concern, FHI's research monitors, who had been visiting the site for years, made light of the problems. Their on-the-ground solution to the nevirapine toxicity problem in Africa was to simply not monitor for safety, says Farber. Dr. Smith realized the monumental implications of her findings, which jeopardized the mission-critical project to license nevirapine to prevent maternal-to-child transmission of HIV. Dr. Smith therefore trod delicately. She concluded her report by stating, "Safety reporting did not follow DAIDS reporting requirements during the conduct of HIV-NET-012. Safety conclusions from this trial should be very conservative." Dr. Fauci had sold his nevirapine enterprise as a heroic moment for American greatness, recalls Celia Farber. Dr. Fauci said he was going to save African pregnant women and their babies. It turns out that this is an extremely dangerous drug with no demonstrated ability to save a single life. This isn't rocket science. Dr. Fauci knew all about the safety problems, but for Fauci and his cult of HIV drug worship, no drug is ever unsafe. Farber researched the episode extensively for her 2006 article in Harper's Magazine, "Out of Control, AIDS and the Corruption of Medical Science." Dr. Smith's conclusions in her safety report, if allowed to stand, would kill nevirapine's chances of winning FDA approval for preventing maternal-to-child transmission. Despite all these setbacks, NIAID's powerful apparatchik didn't seem to fret that FDA was now unlikely to grant nevirapine its official safety imprimatur. Dr. Fauci employed the same ploy that Bob Gallo used when he recruited Margaret Heckler as his useful idiot to convince the world that NIH's intrepid scientists had identified the viral culprit behind AIDS. By now, Dr. Fauci was acting on a much larger stage. On January 29, 2003, the new president took the podium at his State of the Union speech and announced Dr. Fauci's new program to the world, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR. On the continent of Africa, nearly 30 million people have the AIDS virus, yet across that continent, only 50,000 AIDS victims, only 50,000, are receiving the medicine they need. I ask the Congress to commit $15 billion over the next 5 years, including nearly $10 billion in new money, to turn the tide against AIDS in the most afflicted nations of Africa and the Caribbean. His power to deliver a $15 billion health program and to summon unprecedented accolades from a sitting president gave Dr. Fauci unchallengeable power over the entire U.S. health bureaucracy unmatched in American history. He now enjoyed consolidated power over HHS and all its subsidiaries. After Bush's State of the Union, all of HHS fell in line behind Dr. Fauci's project to rewrite history, recalls Farber. The political stakes were very high. To save the reputation of his boss and employer, and by extension everyone else implicated in this scandal, Ed Tremont rose to the task. Tremont went to work by eliminating inconvenient facts recorded by Betsy Smith and top regulatory compliance officer in the NIH's AIDS division, Mary Ann Luzar, by reorganizing the disqualified Uganda data. When DAIDS released Tremont's edited version of the remonitoring report on March 30, 2003, Dr. Smith's safety review had vanished. In its place was a safety section Tremont later admitted having ghostwritten. Tremont had begun with a straightforward revision of the Safety Review Committee's conclusion, altering it from unfavorable to favorable. Tremont's purged draft boldly concluded, single-dose nevirapine is a safe and effective drug for preventing mother-to-infant transmission of HIV. This has been proven by multiple studies, including the HIV-NET-012 study conducted in Uganda. Tremont began massaging data sets to conform the rest of the report to this adjusted outcome. Tremont dismissed concerns raised by Luzar about pediatric liver problems and forged in his own bleached conclusions that the drug was safe. In Dr. Fishbein's words, Tremont simply rewrote the safety section, minimizing concerns about the toxicities, deaths, and record-keeping problems that had been highlighted by his medical safety expert. Tremont's editing skills produced a document that laid the foundation in December 2002 for FDA's approval of the lethal concoction for global use on pregnant women. The Presidential Seal of Approval. Then Teflon Tony played his trump card. Dr. Fauci's coup de grace was a White House announcement that Bush would anoint the scandal-ridden nevirapine project with a personal site visit. The presidential junket would serve as a kind of public purification ritual to purge away the scandal and anoint nevirapine with legitimacy. The special bravado that allowed Dr. Fauci to summon a president to a distant continent and to make Dr. Fauci's personal agenda the centerpiece of White House foreign policy was a demonstration of power that could only provoke the entire awestruck public health bureaucracy to stand at attention and salute. What FDA bureaucrat would now have the courage to taint this prestigious HHS triumph with awkward questions about safety and efficacy? Dr. Fauci wanted the HIV-NET site reopened for President Bush's visit, Dr. Fishbein told me. That visit was such an embarrassment to all of us who knew the truth, but everyone fell into line. The USAID's media even began to refer to Museveni suddenly as a benevolent dictator. Farber remarks, that presidential junket was so transparently phony, a shameless exercise in colonial public relations and lies. On July 11, 2003, President Bush toured the clinical trial site in Kampala, which DAIDS had hurriedly reopened and populated with temporary health workers for the occasion. Dr. Fishbein explained to me, NIAID officials rushed to reopen the site despite my concerns that it wasn't ready. But Tremont overruled me. He wanted the restriction lifted ASAP because, in his words, the site is now the best in Africa run by black Africans, and President Bush was scheduled to be there in 4 days. Said Farber, NIAID officials rushed to reopen the site to paper over the disgrace and to impress and deceive the president. She added, it was really straight up, Potemkin's Village, a vast PR campaign with nothing behind the Hollywood facade except death. Dead babies, dead mothers, we will never know their names. Almost all of HHS was now behind Dr. Fauci's project to rewrite history. In July 2002, DAIDS announced that it would reassess the Uganda nevirapine study. Presenting awards to one another is a knee-jerk strategy by which vaccine experts paper over malefactions and atrocities. It is therefore not surprising that, to advance the cover-up and absolve the Uganda research team, Tremont recommended that Dr. Fauci get his putative NIH boss, Elias Zerhuni, to present Dr. Jackson and his Uganda project researchers who had supervised the African debacle with an NIH award. This strategy would co-opt the NIH director into the cover-up and fortify institutional resistance to a full-blown investigation. Tremont assigned the task to his flunky, DAIDS's deputy director John Kagan, but in a rare display of independent good judgment, Kagan protested that giving awards to the clowns who had killed all those Africans probably with criminal negligence, was a bridge too far. We cannot lose sight of the fact that they screwed up big time. And you bailed their asses out, he advised Tremont by email. I'm all for forgiveness, etc. I'm not for punishing them. But it would be over the top to me to be proclaiming them as heroes. Something to think about before pushing this award thing. But the conspirators had a problem. NIH medical officers Betsy Smith and Mary Ann Luzar were not willing participants to the cover-up. To tie up the last loose ends, Kagan ordered NIAID's ethics officer, Dr. Jonathan Fishbein, to reprimand Luzar for insubordination. The admonishment would bring the agency's ethics division into the cover-up and create an insurance policy if Luzar blabbed to anyone about all those African kids with collapsed livers. An official reprimand from a supposedly independent ethics officer would allow NIAID to discredit Luzar as a disgruntled employee. But Dr. Fishbein's investigation convinced him that the whistleblower Luzar was a hero. He told Tremont that he could find no justification for Luzar's reprimand and advised him against issuing the official rebuke. They were out to get her because she refused to compromise her integrity, Dr. Fishbein told me. Faced with Dr. Fishbein's resistance, Tremont backed down. In Dr. Fishbein, Dr. Fauci's team had run up against a public health official naive enough or conscientious enough to say no. Meanwhile, Dr. Fishbein's investigation of Luzar gave him additional reasons to mistrust Kagan's judgment. Female employees reported to Dr. Fishbein that Kagan was sexually harassing them. Tremont may have felt that Dr. Fishbein was purposefully goading him when, instead of rebuking Luzar, Dr. Fishbein filed a sexual harassment complaint against Tremont's sidekick and enforcer. Kagan was Fauci's bagman, AP reporter John Solomon told me. He was a career Army guy from Fort Detrick or Walter Reed. Dr. Fishbein concurred in this assessment. He was a just-following-orders kind of guy, brought in to put a layer of insulation between Fauci and all the institutionalized mismanagement in his HIV clinical trials. Dr. Fishbein adds that the corruption that had begun with AZT then metastasized throughout the entire program. Dr. Fishbein adds, the sexual harassment issues aside, Kagan was a miserable manager. Boehringer Ingelheim never resubmitted its application to the FDA for preventing maternal-to-child transmission of HIV. Nevertheless, WHO, which, as we shall soon see, was by then under the control of Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci, began shipping this lethal concoction to developing nations globally to use on their pregnant women. It's a mystery why Nevirapine was ever developed, launched, or marketed to the developing world the way it was, says journalist Celia Farber, since it was rejected by every Western drug safety agency, every single time. Why was it then repurposed and shipped to non-Westerners? The double standard is quite stark. We need to start calling it what it is. Says Dr. Fishbein, the tragic irony here is that the Kampala-Nevirapine research was performed to a level of standards that would be insufficient for supporting the drug's approval for use in the United States. But Fauci fervently defended the study as adequate to justify giving Nevirapine to black Africans. Frankly, it strikes me as racist. Reverend Jesse Jackson echoed Fishbein's sentiment. This was not a thoughtful and reasonable decision, but a crime against humanity. Research standards and drug quality that are unacceptable in the U.S. and other Western countries must never be pushed onto Africa.